write numerical algorithms that, given a channel on 47 dimensions, will estimate these quantities as an efficient function of 47. But if you want to develop a simple mathematical theory of what these quantities are, then presumably you'd like a simple characterization that can probably also be computed well. So I'm going to present evidence that such characterizations don't exist. So I'll start off by talking about things you want to compute. Then I'll talk about the quantum E meter, which I put on the first slide, and briefly some implications of this work. And so I'll begin with things you want to compute. That's actually by far the biggest part of the talk. Also, things you've mostly heard before. So the alpha norm of the Shatten alpha norm is this quantity. The min alpha Reni entropy is this thing. The analogous thing for channels are the 1 to alpha norm is the largest alpha norm of any output, given that the input has 1 norm equal to 1. So this is, I would say, the first goal that we have is something we want to compute. We want to compute superoperator norms. So N is a superoperator. We want to compute various norms of it. In particular, the 1 to alpha norm is often of interest. Another thing we want to compute often is the minimum output entropy. So we have a channel, and we want to ask, what is the least noisy output that's possible from this channel? And this has intimate relations to many problems in information theory. And it's been generalized to not just the case of von Neumann entropy, but to Reni entropies as well. And of course, this is mathematically completely equivalent to computing the superoperator norm. We talked about it in different settings, but it's, you know, one of them is just the log times some factors of the other. So I'll use these two interchangeably, but more often talk about SL1. As you heard in Stanislav's talk, probably before that too, an important way to think about channels is the Steinspring dilation. So a channel is an isometry from Alice to Bob tensor Eve, followed by tracing out Eve. The interesting thing here is just to think of this as a subspace V. That's a subspace of the Bob tensor Eve space. Now, S alpha min is just the least entangled state, or the entanglement of the least entangled state on a subspace. And this is sort of the third version of goal number one. Again, a completely mathematically equivalent problem, and another basic question, which is, if I have a subspace, can I say that every state on this subspace it has at least 27.3 bits of entanglement? So an important work here is this one. And as you heard about this morning, there are many other ways of proving this sort of result. Okay, so on the one hand, we'd like to prove that generic subspaces have large minimum entanglement, or we might want to explicitly construct such subspaces. But more generally, we would like to have some good theory that tells us, given a subspace, what this quantity is. And so this is not so far from wanting an efficient algorithm to compute it. For example, if you can, if the eigenvalues of a matrix are something that we're often interested in, and it's the fact that there's an efficient algorithm to compute it is related to the fact that we can say a lot of useful things about the eigenvalues. Okay, so for a lot of this talk, I'm going to specialize to the case when alpha is equal to infinity, and this is not a big restriction, because if the infinity Reni entropy is at least a constant, then so are all the other Reni entropies, because all the other Reni entropies are at least as large as the infinity Reni entropy. And in the other direction, if the infinity Reni entropy is zero, then all the other Reni entropies are zero. And I'm going to talk later about the hardness of distinguishing the case when this S infinity is zero and the case when S infinity is at least some small constant. So talking about this, I'm going to specialize to this, but the results will carry over to the other alphas. So there's one important characterization of this. So this E infinity is the least entangled state on this subspace in the infinity Reni entropy. In other words, if you you want to maximize overall states in the subspace, the largest Schmidt value of the state. And that's equivalent to asking for the largest overlap with any product state, so product between Bob and Eve. And now, if you turn these maxima around, so you fix B and epsilon, and you maximize over psi the overlap between beta, epsilon, and psi, this is equivalent to just projecting beta and epsilon onto a subspace. Because if you have a vector and you want the maximum inner product between that vector and something in a vector space, that's the same as the norm of the vector you get when projecting onto that subspace. So that explains this line. To go from this line to this line, here SEP means the set of separable density matrices. And I'm using the fact that SEP is a convex set. So and its extreme points are the product states of the form beta, tensor, epsilon. I'm maximizing a linear function over a convex set. The maximum is always achieved by an extreme point. So this maximum over this, basically the convex hull of all the product set states, is the same as just maximizing over product states. Finally, I want to define this last thing to be the, I'll define it to be a norm of a matrix. So it's this SEP norm here is defined to be the maximum trace M row over all separable row. And Marius is no longer here, but if you were, he would appreciate that this is the same as that quantity that he introduced in his talk. And this is yet another goal that that is of interest. We'd like to know how to do this on a computer. We'd also like to get some nice theory of what this norm looks like and how can we characterize it. And as you can see, it's completely equivalent to goal number one in the case when alpha equals infinity. Okay. I want to now go into the world of Merlin-Arthur games and very briefly introduce some ideas from complexity theory, since my talk is about hardness. So everything starts with P, things we can solve in polynomial time. This thing's a little bit cut off, huh? Well, I'll just describe to you. That's a comma there that you're missing. Half of an M. I shouldn't push any buttons here, right? Definitely not. Okay, so P is, you know what P is. NP you can think of as, if the answer is yes, there's a witness that will always convince you that the answer is yes. If the answer is no, no witness ever will. MA is like a randomized relaxation of this. They have these parameters, C and S. C is completeness. It says if the answer is yes, there is a witness that will convince me with at least probability C. So often this is taken to be 2/3, but it'll be interesting to change that number around. No instances are accepted with probability at most S. So think of it as the answer is really no, but the malicious prover is trying to convince you that the answer is yes. But no matter what proof he gives you, you won't be fooled. At least you probably won't be fooled. The maximum probability that you'll accept is S, soundness, which is usually 1/3. The reason they're called Merlin-Arthur games is Merlin is the prover, and he is infinitely wise, but he's a druid and sort of fey and untrustworthy, whereas Arthur is an ordinary polynomial time bloke, but he's very rich, so he has a lot of coins, which he can flip. So that's MA, and if Arthur is very rich, he can build a quantum computer. And it's the same thing now. It's a quantum verifier, and the witness, Merlin, can now supply him with a quantum state, and again, the answer is yes, he should accept the probability greater than C. If it's no, probability at most S. And one variant, which is not interesting classically, but is interesting quantumly, is QMAK, which is that there are, one way to think about this is that there are K Merlins, each providing a different proof. And these Merlins are not entangled, so the proof they supply will be a product state. And sometimes we want to really dress it up with all these letters. This means that the messages from each Merlin have m qubits, but there are k Merlins, and S and C are the soundness and completeness. And so if I omit the m, I often mean that the messages are polynomial length. That's the story with NP. The witness is polynomial in the length of the input. But it's interesting here to consider other values of m as well. Similarly, S and C sort of by default are 1/3, 2/3, but it's interesting to consider other values of that. In fact, before our work, it wasn't known whether different values of soundness and completeness were equivalent to each other. And I'll get into that in a minute. So one way to think about QMAK is as an optimization problem. So What the verifier is doing is a measurement. On the Merlins are going to supply some witness, and the verifier is going to make a measurement, and then the result of the measurement will be either accept or reject. So let's say that M is the outcome corresponding to accept, and identity minus M is the reject outcome. So this is the witness. It's K states, each with M qubits. And then the state is phi. And when I use phi without the ket, I mean the projector onto it. And so the acceptance probability is trace of M times phi. And so you can think of this problem, QMA K, as saying, we want to determine whether this maximum, where the maximum is taken over the appropriate product states, is either bigger than C or less than S. So it's like saying we want to approximate this maximum. We don't have to determine it exactly. We just have to determine, distinguish between these cases if it's rather high or it's rather low. So when K is 1, this is just finding the largest eigenvalue of M. And this is something that we have a nice characterization of. You can, M is size 2 to the little m, so we can diagonalize it in time polynomial in 2 to the m. So we can solve this in time exponential in m. This is a way of saying that if you have the ground state of a quantum system of on n qubits, then you can find that ground state in time exponential in n. When k is 2, we no longer know how to do this. So we don't even know if we can solve this in exponential time. So this problem now is precisely equivalent to estimating this SEP norm. So we want to know whether the SEP norm is greater or equal than C or less than or equal to S. So that's why I call goal 2B, solving problems in QMA2, it's precisely equivalent to goal 2A, estimating this SEP norm. And a priori, it appears harder because we don't even know how to solve this in time exponential in M. Another way to say exponential in M is polynomial in the dimension. So computing this, that's maybe a nicer way to think about it. You want to compute this SEP norm on a D by D matrix. We don't know how to do that in time polynomial in D. Of course, there might be even harder versions. So for general K, you don't have this SEP norm. You've got a degree K polynomial in this, I'm assuming now that all K provers give you the same proof, which is a reasonable restriction, in which case we're optimizing over degree K polynomials. In principle, this could be harder. It'll turn out that it's equivalent to QMA2, but at this point, you should find that surprising fact. Okay, that's one thing about QMA2 I want to say. The other thing I want to talk about, which will become relevant later, is the problem of amplification. So we want to know whether this, do you get a different complexity class for every choice of soundness and completeness, or are they all somewhat equivalent to one another if you're allowed to repeat the proof a few times? So the classic example of amplification is if you just have a randomized algorithm, or say a coin, which outputs heads, and you want to estimate the probability that your algorithm outputs a particular thing, like heads, and you know that this probability is either greater than or equal to C or less than or equal to S. And you want to be able to distinguish these two cases with great certainty. So, for example, suppose that C is 62% and S is 61%. This is not really a very acceptable parameter for an algorithm. You'd like to be, 99.9% sure of your answer. So what you do is you simply repeat many, many times. And by a turnoff bound, you can show that eventually you get exponentially small probability of guessing the wrong thing. You do majority voting, and you get the right answer. So this works for things where there's no prover. But it also works when there's one prover. And this problem is sometimes called parallel repetition. There's one prover. We can't just reuse the same copy of the proof because our measurement, with more cleverness we can. But the simple thing to do is ask for R copies of a proof. So this is like repeating the thing R times. If the answer is yes, the prover just gives us R independent copies. And we know the sort of binomial statistics of how many of these will accept. If the answer is no, we have to worry about the prover being devious and tricking us with an entangled proof. So we'd like the prover just to give us independent things, each one of which accepts with probability at most S. But the prover, knowing about things like Bell inequalities, can try to entangle these proofs and maybe get us to accept the overall thing with higher probability. With one prover, this does not work. Because if you look at the first proof, it by itself is some density matrix, and your probability of accepting that will be at most S. You measure it. Conditioned on your measurement outcome, the remaining R minus 1 proofs become something, but whatever they are, each individual proof by itself still will be accepted with probability at most S. So another way of saying that is if you have these R copies, after you measure the first one, you can let the prover replace the remaining R minus 1 with whatever he likes. It's not going to help because each individual system by itself will be accepted with probability at most S. So same kind of repetition goes through for QMA1. QMA2, this does not work. And the problem is you have these two provers, each independently supplying you with R copies of their proof, and the proofs are unentangled between the two provers, but they might be entangled between themselves. So I should draw this. So let's say R is 4. You ask for 4 copies of the proof from the first prover and 4 from the second prover. Since it's a no instance, they're trying to trick you into thinking that the answer is yes. They'll try and cheat. They might entangle across these 4 and do some entanglement across these 4. Now, you make a measurement on the first 2, and this measurement, conditioned on the outcome, might induce entanglement on the remaining 6. In general, measurements have the tendency to do this, unless you're doing a separable measurement. But if you're not doing a separable measurement, you might induce entanglement on the rest. Then you have no guarantee about what happens next. Your measurement strategy only is guaranteed to work if these guys are forced to be unentangled. If there's entanglement, you have no, all bets are off.
There was no entanglement to begin with between the two groups.
That's our assumption. That's QMA2. So the definition of QMA2 is that there are two provers who are not entangled, who each supply for the proof. And the fact that we have to make that assumption, we can't just have one prover give us two parts and force them to be product, is why QMA2 is probably different from QMA1. Okay, so the provers may be able to cheat in principle. Well, you know, maybe this isn't a problem. In fact, they can cheat. And by the equivalences I've showed you, the failure of perfect parallel repetition, in other words, the failure of this probability to be independent, is precisely equivalent to additivity violations in minimum output S infinity. So these cheating strategies do in fact exist, and since these additivity violations in some cases can be pretty good, they can get there's some pretty good cheating opportunities that exist. So this amplification naively doesn't work. If you do something a little bit trickier, you can amplify completeness at the cost of degrading soundness. That was shown by these two papers. These papers also show that if you could do strong amplification, so the sort of this kind of amplification, then QMA2 would equal QMAK for all values of K greater than 2. And their proof strategy is sort of similar to ours. I won't go into it. Okay, so these are basically the two questions about, so some of the questions about QMA are how QMA2 is how hard is it to compute, and how dependent is it on these parameters S and C. If we can amplify, then it's pretty much the same no matter what S and C are. If we can't, then it's a much more complicated beast. I'll return to that later. Now I want to talk about some more things that we want to compute. So one other thing we want to compute sometimes is a mean field Hamiltonian. So we often want to find the ground state of a Hamiltonian. One important case of Hamiltonians is when every spin interacts with every other spin. So let's say you have n spins, each of d dimensions. The Hamiltonian for all pairs I and j has an interaction between I and j. And I've written it in this particular form so that the ground state of this Hamiltonian corresponds to, this should be a max. It should correspond to computing the maximum of this quantity. So finding the ground state of this Hamiltonian is equivalent to these previous things. And the reason why this is true is that when you have this kind of symmetric Hamiltonian, you can assume by a sort of DeFinetti type argument that the ground state is also symmetric. And furthermore, that the ground state is close to a product state. So if the ground state is a product state, then, and all of these are equivalent, minimizing this energy is just equivalent to minimizing the trace of this times some product state on two systems. So the whole minimization problem just becomes a minimization problem on two systems. And so you just have to, so then I put a minus sign there, so there should be a max, although I forgot to put that. So then it's just a max of trace of m times rho over two systems. So this is, again, equivalent to all these other goals, 2a and 2b. One more thing that we often want to do is we want to characterize separability. A lot of effort has been put into things like the PPT test and other heuristics for judging whether or not something is separable. The task is, given a density matrix rho, determine whether it's separable. This is generally considered to be a hard, not quite the right way to look at the problem. At least on a computer, it's more natural to allow for some small imprecision. So the weak membership problem with parameter epsilon asks us to determine whether rho is either, we say epsilon within sep means that an epsilon ball around rho is still separate, everything in that ball is separable, or it's epsilon outside sep, meaning that an epsilon ball around rho is entirely outside sep. So in the boundary cases, we just don't have to solve those, and we ask how hard is it to solve this promise problem. So it turns out, so this is the membership problem, weak membership problem for this convex set. The thing we were considering before, this norm here, is the optimization problem over a convex set. And sort of a basic theorem of convex optimization, although it's the proof is really unpleasant and hairy, and I've never actually read it, but other people have told me it's true, is that optimizing a linear function over a convex set is equivalent to this easier, apparently easier problem of weak membership. And the proof involves the ellipsoid algorithm. The idea is that you can run the ellipsoid algorithm only by having a membership oracle plus some mild other assumptions that in this case hold. And in this way, using the weak membership, using an oracle for weak membership, you can solve the linear optimization problem. So again, this goal three is equivalent to the previous goals. One final goal, which as you've seen this morning is not equivalent to the previous ones, is to find the regularized version of these quantities. So I'm going to just note that with a bar, S bar alpha min is this, oh, that should be tensor n. Sorry about that. Otherwise, this would be 0. So minimum output entropy of n copies of this thing. And this is somewhat more relevant than just F alpha min for information theoretic purposes. The most famous one is the regularized minimum output entropy is relevant for the classical capacity. This is proven by Holovo, Schumacher, Westmoreland back in the day. But the other ones are also of interest. So the F0 is related to the zero error capacity. And S infinity is related to something called the strong converse, which says if I communicate through a channel at a rate greater than, let's say, the capacity or greater than some threshold, then every bit, let's say I communicate at a rate of 5 bits more than I should be communicating, then my probability of getting the right message out should go down with n uses of the channel as 2 to the minus 5n. So what it says is that above this threshold, if you try and communicate faster than that, you might as well just guess the remaining bits. So proving such strong converses is interesting for cryptographic applications. And in general, there's various applications of this throughout information theory. So this infinity entropy is also interesting. And I would say our fourth goal is to estimate this regularized quantities. So Beji and Shor showed that estimating this precision polynomial in 1 over D is NP-hard, but this could be a vast understatement. We don't even know if it's computable. So, I think I don't even have a strong position on whether or not it's computable. But it's certainly we can talk about lower bounds on how hard it is. Okay, so these are many, many things that we want to compute, which have some strong relations between them. There are many previous results on these sort of problems, much of which. Many of these didn't really describe the link between these problems that I mentioned, and so in some cases would redo things that other people had done using a totally different language. So the definition of QMAK came from this paper by Kobayashi et al. And they showed this result about amplification implying that QMA2 equals QMAK, and also the fact that the perfect soundness case is uninteresting, that in that case, multiple provers don't help. Beiji Shor showed that it's NP-complete to distinguish basically that what I said about estimating the minimum output entropy is NP-hard to approximate. And the fact that they showed it for an entanglement breaking channel is that means a channel where for such channels, the regularized quantity is the same as the one-shot quantity, so that also shows hardness for that case. Blier and Tapp showed, this is a one there, showed that QMA2 with log-sized messages and perfect completeness and 1 minus 1 over poly soundness contains 3 sounds. So what this means, I'll restate this not in terms of qubits, but in terms of matrices. If I have a D by D matrix, and I want to find, let's say, the SEP norm, this thing I defined earlier, and I want to really compute this to very high accuracy. Let's say I want to compute it to accuracy exponential in D. So this is a... polynomial accuracy in D. I'm going to compute this to polynomial accuracy in D. So this is a D by D thing. If we want to diagonalize it, that takes time polynomial in D, this argues that we probably need exponential time to do that. So it says that this QMA2 really is potentially much, much harder. Aronson et al. Did a similar thing, but with constant soundness. So they showed that now you need root n provers, each with log-sized proofs, to distinguish between success probability 1 and success probability some constant. That's what this 1 minus omega 1 means. It just means constant less than 1. This 2 contains 3 sats. And various equivalent things were also shown about separability. So showing that the weak membership problem for separability is hard is, in a sense, equivalent to showing that this QMA2 class contains 3 sats. These are all sort of in the 1 over polynomial soundness sort of case. So the only one which has a constant soundness is this result by Aronson et al. And this is really the one that's more interesting for the perspective of channels, because you want to say you want your... We're often interested in estimating things up to some universal constant, not up to something that decreases with the dimension. Okay, so that's what previously has been done on this QMA2 business. I want to talk now a little bit about our contribution. So this is me and Ashley Montanaro. And I'm going to do this by returning to the problem of building a quantum E meter. So this problem is the following. We want to detect entanglement. So we're given a state psi, which is belongs to the space of n qubits. And we want to know, is it close to a product state or far from any product state? So it's not hard to see that if you have one copy of the state, this is an impossible task. But if you have two copies, then we have a test which can determine roughly whether psi is close to a product state or not. In particular, let's suppose that the largest overlap between psi and any product state is 1 minus epsilon. Then our test will pass, it will output product, with probability 1 minus something linear in epsilon. And by linear in epsilon, I mean at most 1 minus epsilon and at least 1 minus epsilon over 50. Or actually, the other way around. But bounded in some range between 1 minus epsilon and 1 minus epsilon over 50. So not very good constant, but nevertheless, it's something that has no dependence on D or on F. So no matter how many systems or how big they are, it doesn't affect this bound. So the see, this is, you see, part of the E meter is a key primitive in the E meter is something called the swap test. So it takes two systems, and you want to test to see if they're equal. The systems are rho and sigma. You input a qubit. This H is Hadamard. It's a matrix 1 over root 2 times, I should really write this down, 1, 1, 1, minus 1, 1 over root 2. That's the H. And then this final thing means measure. You either get 0 or 1. And if the outcome of the measurement is 0, then we accept. We say the two states are the same. If not, then we reject. This is equivalent to projecting this onto the symmetric subspace of two qubits, so the plus 1 eigenspace of the swap operator. And the probability of accepting is 1 plus trace rho sigma over 2. So if rho and sigma are the same pure state, you always accept. If they're orthogonal, then you accept with probability 1 half and interpolate in between. If they're mixed, there'll be some chance of being orthogonal, and so the probability will also be less than 1. Now, we make our product test out of the swap test. So we're given two copies of psi, which is distributed across n systems. What we do is we do a swap test on each pair. So we take the first system from each one, second system from each one, et cetera, and swap test these. And we demand that all n swap tests pass. If so, we say it's product. If not, we say it's entangled. And the idea is that if it is product, this will be, phi1, tensor phi2, tensor phi3. Each swap test will be just swapping two identical pure states, so it'll always pass. If not, let's suppose this is density matrix rho and this is rho, then the swap test will accept with probability 1 plus trace rho squared over 2. And so the more, if this state psi is entangled, some of these reduced states will be mixed. So these rhos will be mixed. Trace rho squared will be less than 1. And these things will have some non-negligible chance of failing. Of course, there are a lot of hairy details, but you can read our paper for this. But the intuition is that if it's entangled, some of the subsystems will be mixed, and so the swap test will fail. Okay, so what am I doing? Now I want to talk about the implications of the quantum E meter. The first one is that two provers can simulate K proofs. So why is that? If you have two provers, what I do, let's say I have a K prover protocol. So the K provers were going to submit to me B1, B2, dot, 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 BK. And I want to simulate that using only two provers. What I do is I ask each of these provers to give me this tensor product state, so the tensor product of B1 through BK. I ask each one to do this. Now, the problem is that they can cheat by entangling across these different things. They don't have to give me a product state. If they did give me a product state, I could just do my QMAK measurement on this and be done. But if I just had one copy of the state, I couldn't verify that it was product. However, I have two provers. So I ask them to each give me the same state, and then I can do the product test to verify that it is indeed a product across this K part type split. Of course, they don't have to keep in the same state, but you can show that'll only make it worse for them. Yeah?
For your test of productness to work,
yeah,
you need two copies of psi.
That's right.
Do we have to assume that, in fact, you are being given two copies of psi? In other words, they're not allowed to fool you by actually giving you entangled systems?
They cannot. There's no entanglement between the two provers. They don't have to give me identical systems.
No, sorry, forget the provers here. This is back to the previous part about just testing for product stateness. So
the theorem only works if you have the same state, two copies that are not entangled with one another.
So does that provide any loopholes for the provers?
No, because the provers, by assumption, have to give me, they have to be something here, tensor something here. There's no entanglement between the two provers. Now, they don't have to give me the same state. That's their only loophole. That's their only way to weasel around the theorem, potentially, is to not give me the same state.
Can you flip back to the next? Yeah, okay, so you have each prover to submit phi when tensor phi.
That's what I asked them to submit. Now, they might not do that. They might entangle across these k times. So this is sort of all within, each one hands me one package, right? And within that package, they can do whatever they like. But the two packages have to be
separate. Thanks.
Yeah, so the one detail I'm glossing over is what if the two provers give me different states? But that's not a big deal. So, yeah, so the point is two provers here can seem like k provers, which is sort of an internal thing, but will make our life a lot easier. There are two consequences of this. The first is going back to this Aaronson et al. Protocol.
This one had root n provers, each sending log-sized proofs. Now we get two provers, each sending me roughly root n qubits. And this contains three sets. And that's interesting because it said that we probably, so the states they give me have 2 to the root n, dimension 2 to the root n. And three sat, we think that to solve that takes time 2 to the n. So that is evidence that you can't even get a constant approximation to QMA2 in polynomial time. There's one other feature of this, which is interesting, which is the protocol you get from here results in M, which is a separable operator. And why is that? Well, you're projecting onto symmetric subspaces, and this is a separable operator. And then you do the QMAK test just for one of the two proofs. So each prover separately gives you this, and then once you're convinced you have that, you just do a test which is entirely on the side of one of the provers or the other. So this simulation protocol, even if you set k equal to 2 here, so you have two provers simulate another two-prover protocol, sounds pointless, but now you've turned an arbitrary two-prover protocol into a two-prover protocol where M is separable. So this is like an entanglement-breaking channel. Now you have the strong amplification. So, yes?
I didn't just say quantize NP. Is there a reason?
Because there's NP has these weird polynomial equivalences.
Mm-hmm.
So the proof, you know, you might have NP. So I want the witness length to be linear in my input size.
Mm-hmm.
If the witness length might be quadratic in my input size, then this root n becomes n, and then it's no longer interesting. I might be wrong about that being a problem. I haven't thought about it very hard. But it made me nervous, so I thought I'd be safe by telling you. Yeah, the point is, the big contradiction that, you know, we want to avoid
is that you can solve 3-sat in time 2 to the root n. This is not the kind of catastrophe of solving in time polynomial n, but still would be highly unlikely. Okay, so now we've managed, this solved the amplification problem in two ways. First, if two provers can simulate k-provers can do an amplified version of two provers, because now you really do have independent proofs. You can be confident that they're independent. The problem is you've lost some soundness here, so that gets in the way of your ability to really amplify as much as you'd like. The second approach is that M is now a separable operator, lets you really amplify to your heart's content. And so now we get this strong amplification that we would get for, you know, things like flipping a coin or things you do without any proofs. So what this means is if you have poly-sized proofs, then you don't really have to stress about soundness and completeness. Just like for randomized algorithms, you get pretty much the same complexity class no matter what the completeness and soundness are. The other thing that we get from M being a separable operator is that we get something where we have strong amplification, which means that the regularized S min, we can take something where S infinity min is at least epsilon, and we get something where the regularized S infinity min is at least epsilon divided by some universal constant. So that means that our hardness results here turn into hardness results here. And so this is gives the headline result of the talk, which is that the classical capacity is hard to approximate even up to a constant factor. So we're going back to this result here, that 3-sat can be proven with a root n qubits from two different provers. And so what this means is that distinguishing the cases that a channel can have S infinity min equal to 0 and S infinity min greater than epsilon, unfortunately, it's not NP hard, it's NP log squared hard. So that's this set of problems where your witness has log squared N bits. And so that's it's far from NP hard, but still does not seem like something we can do in polynomial time. Another way of saying this is if we could do it in polynomial time, then we could solve 3-sat in time 2 to the root n, which is believed not be true. So an alternate way of describing these results is the following alternate title: detecting pure state entanglement is easy, therefore detecting mixed state entanglement is hard. So pure state entanglement, that's our E meter, and then our hardness of approximation for the separable states is the fact that mixed state entanglement is, we get a hardness result for that. Of course, detecting means different things than the two problems. Yeah?
When you say poly time, is that polynomial in the dimension of the input and over space to the channel?
Yes. So the number of numbers you described. So there are many, many interesting open questions.
So this QMA log with constant soundness, we know belongs to NP and contains NP log squared. There's a huge gulf between these. And I once upon a time thought this was an esoteric, uninteresting class. But after noticing how many things it connects to, I now find it an interesting thing to resolve which of these extremes it belongs to. If it belongs to this extreme, and we can get something to approximate all these quantities, like the separable norm in time d to the log d, that would be very interesting. I think any new results here would be great. The case of polynomial-sized proofs, also the complexity is pretty open. And of course, parallel repetition is interesting, even aside from these computational questions. The regularized minimum output entropy is always less than or equal to the single shot thing, but we'd like to say it's greater than or equal to some function of the single shot entropy. And all we know so far is that it's greater than or equal to the single shot entropy divided by d log d, which is a pretty pitiful bound. The only thing to be able to achieve is that it can sometimes be less than s over 2. So there's a big gulf between how much less this can be in principle and how much we've observed. Also, the analysis of our product state, our product test could be improved in many ways, which I don't want to talk about that too much. I want to instead close with an important message from our sponsors. This is, again, the quantum e-meter. In fact, the Mark Super 7 quantum e-meter. And its laser precision means everything for rapid progress up the bridge, yours and everyone you audit. So keep that in mind. And I also, before I take questions, I want us all to thank the organizers for a conference that's been really great.
That's it. Thanks for your attention. Any questions?
Okay, that almost attended the conference.
True. What's the complexity of evaluating the fastest possible channel?
Polynomial, because it's convex. There's this algorithm by Andreas.
I know the players.
What's the second one?
Richard Layout.
Layout? Layout.
Layout.
But basically,
it's convex optimization.
Yeah, because it's convex convergence like that. Of course, so the thing is that set of separable states is also convex. So you think you could maximize over that, but you have to be able to, you know, can you determine membership? That's the problem.
So, two questions actually. One is I wanted to follow up on something you said in response to that question, which is that I asked whether it was the complexity was not super polynomial in the dimension. You said yes, it's not poly in the number of parameters used to describe it, and that's confusing because the original paper by Shor and or by Ajay that we're at on the difficulty of estimating minimum output entropy actually showed it for n qubit channels. that were efficient, that had a very efficient description. So there, the Hilbert space dimension was growing exponentially in the number of parameters used to describe it. It was confusing me.
Oh, I probably made a mistake in characterizing your work. But some of the others do achieve that result. Like the Beji by himself paper and the Li et al. Paper.
So it's definitely bad in the Hilbert space dimension.
Oh, yeah.
Second question was about, in your list of papers, the bottom one.
Yes, sort of an outlier.
That's but another, yeah, by any sure.
This is not even nothing computational here. Okay. But what this says, I just want to say briefly, the thing about this is we don't just care about algorithms first. In several cases, we want good mathematical characterizations. PPC is a nice mathematical characterization because it's a semi-definite optimization. Not only can we do it on a computer, but we can use things like duality and so on. And they show that it doesn't even come close to approximating the set of separable states. And this sort of, I think, an example of a broader principle, which is that there's not going to be a nice mathematical characterization of separable states if by nice we mean efficiently computable. So,
a short comment? So in a similar spirit, Staszek Szarek, who is here, showed that he compared volume of two sets of PPT and separable, and also just showed that this volume of the set of PPT of the separable states is small in comparison to the set of PPT states, which basically is the same similar conclusion.
Yes. Of course, it could be that if you have d-dimensions and one set is smaller than the other one, if like the other one times 1 minus 1 over root d, then its volume will be much smaller, but it'll still be very close, right? So it could be that your volume is smaller, but you still are quite close. And he says, you've got things that are trace distance practically 2 apart. I mean, it's really like very, very far apart.
Yeah, the estimate actually goes through the mean widths. So this means that in a typical direction, one of them is much wider than the other.
Oh, so that's actually...
This is not that different from this.
It's not like
constant 2 or something, but it's not...
No, it's
a substantial difference.
Right? But it gives the same message somehow.
Yeah, no, you're right. It does give the same message. Thanks. So I just avoided your question.
No, actually, I think Carol pretty much answered.
Okay.
Well, you guys both answered, except for, does this apply to the hierarchy by Doherty at all?
Yeah, because that's also, at least the low levels of it, is efficiently computable. So, you know, anything efficiently computable. I forget if they directly address the hierarchy. I mean, you know, they do it without any computational assumptions. So, it says also that things like this hierarchy, which are efficiently computable, also will not always do a good job.
So they prove that everything that's efficiently computable will do a poor job.
No, our results do that. Okay. They have some other broad criteria which I forgot, but they, you know, which I think include the hierarchy.
Does this apply to the case where you fix one dimension?
No.
So could it be that deciding separability is it's doable in polynomial time or efficiently? If L's dimension is 3 and only Bob's dimension runs?
Yeah, I mean definitely if one dimension is constant, you can always enumerate over an epsilon net over that smaller space. I haven't fully explored that, but something like that should be possible. You could also use sort of Finetti arguments to simulate that using one quantum group. You know, you could ask for let's say you have a qubit, a tensor with many other things. You can simulate that with one qubit now, with one prover now, by asking for many, many copies of that qubit. And then the Finetti theorem will essentially let you make that product with the remainder of the proof. So I would say if one of the messages is constant size, then that's exactly the complexity class QMA1, one prover.
But the uneven case is interesting in general.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank Aaron.